Good morning. Greater flexibility for the FDA and pharmaceutical companies is at the heart of a bill on today's schedule in the U.S. Senate. We'll get a read of the 21st Century Cures Act from the head of Hawaii's Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research, Dr. Steve Fortman. And it took almost 20 years. Now there's a plea in the case of Peterboy Chema. UH Law Professor Ken Lawson looks at the art of this deal. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Jennifer Belgray's Kauai Dance Center enters its 20th year of instructing and inspiring lovers of the dance. And author and soon-to-be film director Stacey Hayashi has just started work on a feature film about the 100th Infantry Battalion and 442nd Regimental Combat Team called Go For Broke. She's with us in our studio.
It's Monday, December 5th. That's The Conversation coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, this today where we can't start the morning without saying that certainly our hearts go out to all of the families affected by that blaze in Oakland.
Yeah.
Many of us have friends and family there, and we're busy over the weekend trying to figure out what was going on as we were watching these reports.
Yeah, much more to still come in from that terrible story, yeah.
And why people were allowed to be there in the first place,
yeah.
When clearly authorities knew about the building and the lack of permitting. It's going to be one that many of us will be following.
Yeah.
But here we are on a Monday, many more things going on as well.
Well, we often wonder why it takes as long as it does for a medical advance to actually be implemented, right?
We do. And sometimes that really has to do with how it can get through the FDA and what may take its time in bringing a certain drug to market.
Now, exactly.
That's behind our first story today. Now, the U.S. Senate is scheduled to vote to end discussion on the 21st Century Cures Act. It's already been passed by the House. Supporters insist that it would make it possible to move a drug to market faster and give more flexibility to the FDA. The flip side could be more room for mistakes and a 30% cut to the Prevention and Public Health Fund created by Obamacare. We call Dr. Steve Fortman, the interim director of Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research Hawaii, to get his read on the balance between streaming the process and potential risk.
It's good to give the FDA more resources, which this bill does. They've had a lot of trouble hiring people for many years, and we need more FDA scientists to help evaluate drugs. And for serious diseases, it's helpful to have a process that's a bit more streamlined. The problem is that the way this works is to shorten the clinical trials that need to be done to get approval to market a drug. And the main way to do that is to use what we call surrogate endpoints. A good example is in cancer. So let's say you have a tumor and you're getting a drug to treat that. You really want to know if the drug lengthens your lifespan, but that takes a long time to study. So this bill makes it easier to get approval based on something like a measurement of the tumor. And if it shrinks, then we say, well, the drug's probably working. The problem with that is a number of drugs have been licensed under those rules, and much of the time, the later studies don't show any improvement in lifespan, and these are often very expensive drugs, so you really would like to know that there's long-term efficacy. So I think that it could be a good development overall, providing the FDA really has the resources to monitor these drugs after they're marketed, and to make sure that the longer-term studies are done.
So you mentioned long-term efficacy that might or might not be able to be judged by a short-term gain, but you haven't mentioned the issue about side effects, because if something were to be cut short, how would we possibly know that there could be side effects attached to this, let alone whether or not it's actually able to treat whatever disease this drug might be able to treat?
That's an excellent point and quite true. In clinical research studies, you need more time to see what adverse effects are true of the drug. And even with sort of traditional trials, like several heart disease drugs were approved after a trial that might have been 2 or 3 or even 4 years long, but it was cut short from its planned duration because the drug was shown to be effective. But then we don't really know what the side effects are. So that point is quite true.
One group that might not even care about side effects of any sort might be those who have been diagnosed as terminal, where anything looks good given the alternative. Should there be specific criteria or a different category or way of potentially judging the efficacy of a drug or just the ability to try a drug that might do something for someone who is terminal?
That has been part of the argument, and it's quite true. If you have a disease that's probably going to kill you within a year, you are willing to try things that are more experimental. And that has been the case, I think, for many of the drugs that have been approved in a more rapid fashion. But even then, you want to have the long-term studies to show that it really does benefit you. To take a drug that might be costing $10,000 or $20,000 a month for 6 months, you'd like to know that it's actually lengthening lifespan.
Unless you would be part of a study in which some of that long-term data would be gleaned from the short-term that someone who is terminal might be using it. So what's the way around it, or do you see that there's a way around any of this to be able to help people who are willing to try anything and those who might be facing many different types of diseases or conditions for which a long-term study might be more appropriate before that particular drug were to enter the market?
This is a case of judgment in each individual drug, and that's why you need well-trained scientists at the FDA to help make that determination. It's certainly true that treatments for diseases that are rapidly fatal, we can stretch the rules. As long as there's adequate follow-up and due diligence after the drug is marketed and the trials are continued, or at least the follow-up is continued, we don't have as good a mechanism in this country to follow drugs after they're marketed as we'd like. But there is potential for that, and the FDA has been developing that so-called post-marketing surveillance. Those systems need to be enhanced. I don't know that this bill does that per se, but with more staff at the FDA and more funding for the FDA, they should be able to do that. But it's something to watch very carefully.
In terms of the research that would be done to bring a drug to market, there is some concern that whatever, you know, pool of money might be available to do research on a particular disease or on a particular drug for that disease, that will pull research to that situation as opposed to looking at others that might also need to be researched and for which drugs need to be developed. Are you at all concerned about that?
I don't know that this bill changes that specifically, but it's a very big bill and there were a lot of lobbyists involved, so we won't know all of the ins and outs of it for quite a while.
But in terms of the research grants becoming more available, doesn't that play into this as well?
Right. Part of the bill increases funding to the NIH, and that's a part that many of us like. The NIH funding has been falling in real terms since 2003. This helps to restore that to some degree, but a lot of it is earmarked for certain research programs like precision medicine and the moonshot. Those will probably develop very good information, but top-down decisions are not always the best way to decide how to do research studies. But NIH tends to spend money based on peer review and fund research that's good. The pharmaceutical industry is more and more interested in drugs that make profit. And so there is a risk, I think, that the profit motive will drive the selection of what gets studied, particularly farther down the pipeline when you're getting to clinical trials, rather than necessarily than need.
And in all of this, you know, there's always how these drugs are going to be made available. As the approval process is really the heart and soul of this, do you have anything in your mind that would want to dissuade the Senate from approving this bill?
I think one of the biggest problems with the bill is that the funding for this is to be taken out of the Prevention and Public Health Fund. which was created by the ACA in 2009. And that fund is meant to change the emphasis of healthcare from treating patients who walk in the door to prevention and to building up our public health infrastructure, which is greatly in need of building up. So what I would like to see the Senate do is figure out a different way to fund this, because there's really no need to take away money from prevention and from public health to fund this particular bill.
You brought up the ACA. We know that that has been a target during the campaign and now of the new administration. Are you at all concerned that this may all, in fact, be moot if the ACA is either restructured or change in some ways in which the prevention funds might not be available, period?
That's correct. In fact, I think the idea of taking this out of the Prevention and Public Health Fund is directly related to the animosity towards the ACA. This is not the first time that fund has been raided, so I do think it's wrapped up in that. I think the good parts of this bill would not be affected by changes in the ACA, but if the changes that have been discussed go through, it will restrict the availability of any drugs and other treatment for the people who have obtained health insurance through the ACA. That's a major concern, and I think we all need to be concerned about that. And Hawaii was, you know, in the forefront of providing health insurance to most of the population. So that concerns me a lot. I don't know, other than the raid on the Prevention and Public Health Fund, I don't know that the 21st Century Cures Act is entangled with the ACA otherwise.
Dr. Steve Fortman is Interim Director of Kaiser Permanente Center for Health Research, Hawaii. The U.S. Senate is scheduled to take up the 21st Century Cures Act today.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:16. Coming up, merging the techniques of classical and contemporary dance on Kauai. But first, your quiz.
O Mau, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back to the days when the city and county of Honolulu mayor presided over an unprecedented construction boom. He was a Republican who served as the city's chief executive from 1955 to 1969 and whose name can still be seen on several signature public works projects. He was born in 1902 to a Kamaaina family. His father had been the city's fire chief, and his grandfather had come to the islands from Maine in 1849. His ancestry was Hawaiian on his mother's side, and he was a star athlete at St. Louis School, where he was known as Rusty. In 1945, he was elected as the 4th District Representative to the Hawaii Territorial Legislature and to the Territorial Senate in 1947 and again in 1949. He won election to the mayor's office by defeating Frank Fossey in 1954. This morning, we're looking for his name, and if you know it, you should call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, because if you're first and fast, you get the HPR prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
How many young girls will attend a production of the Nutcracker this holiday season and fall in love with the ballet, a love that will endure throughout their lives? Jennifer Bell Gray was 3 when she saw her first ballet and has been the focus of her life ever since. Jennifer is the co-director and co-founder of the Kauai Dance Center, which offers training in a variety of styles. She's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for inviting me on air.
Well, sure. I gather your life kind of followed that arc of the young girl who was enchanted by a ballet performance. Is that accurate?
That is. That is. When I experienced hearing the music of Tchaikovsky, it wasn't the Nutcracker, it was Swan Lake, mm-hmm. but all of the 3 ballets that became major ballets, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and the Nutcracker, are a major influence today and continue to be so, even 100 years on.
Well, they really speak to young girls for a variety of reasons, yeah?
They do. I think there's so much enchantment in it, and when you see a ballet, when you get to experience a ballet, suddenly now you can go on YouTube and have full access to an entire array of ballets, and even professional companies like the ABT, the Royal Ballet, mm-hmm. and other companies will stream an entire two-hour full-length ballet. So it's wonderful to have this kind of access.
So when you see an entire performance like that, you don't just see the sort of the flashy, glamorous moments. You see the entire narrative, and it has to be understood as a narrative, right?
It is. The ballet itself is really a vehicle, like a voice of an actor, to portray the story and to bring about the context of this world. Also, it's not just the dancing. You are incorporating the artists, the designers. The music has so much to do with it. And so all these 3 components, as well as the energy of the dancers, bring together these spectacular, jigsaw puzzles that come together as one.
Well, it certainly is that. And at the same time, the enchantment that the young dancer, would-be dancer feels, has to then enter a world of very, very hard work, for which I would think not many young kids especially would be prepared.
That's true. There's so the training itself is so meticulous, and to be able to do the same thing, but then, Chris, that's in every sort of discipline, to be able to do the same thing meticulously again and again until it becomes part of you.
Sure, sure. But you have that, you know, you're brought into a world of music or dance or whatever performing art you want to pursue by the highlight moments, right? The glamorous
moments. That's right.
Moments.
Yes, because when you have a vision, I was very fortunate. When I was 3, I had this opportunity to watch one of the top companies in the world perform right from a TV screen. I was living in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. and there at the BBC streamed Swan Lake, music by Tchaikovsky. Natalia Makarova, Anthony Dow was dancing. This was in 1982. And to see how this magic appeared, it made the striving of the work worthwhile, because that was the vision, and you can always help any student or anybody who really wants to get somewhere to keep the vision of what they want to work towards. And that in itself is satisfying.
You have to make a really fundamental decision early on that it's going to be worth it. Or do you?
I think there is a portion of that too. Yes, it has to be worth it enough that you want to keep on doing it.
I would think that.
How would it be? Go ahead.
Well, I would think, Jennifer, that in some of the young students that come to you, very young, that mm-hmm. the shock of how much work they're going to have to do, I would think there'd be a certain amount of attrition. You know, people just sort of realizing it was a little bit too much for them. Do you run into much of that?
We have a program that has sort of two sides to it. There's the dancer who wants to really pursue it. This is their life ambition. And, you know, and more often, it's really something that can contribute to one's life anyway. So the idea that everyone's going to start at, you know, maybe love the ballet and then continue to a professional course, that would be a very few minute handful of individuals. But the joy that ballet can give and dancing can give and the lifetime of enjoyment really can be found within the discipline itself. And so to keep it fun, to keep it lively, to keep it interesting, I mean, one of the things that has always happened is dance has evolved, even from the time when Ninette Diawara created the ballet company in England. She would fuse the modern with the ballet and create new pieces that spoke to the people of the time. And keeping it so that it's accessible, approachable, brings more people into the family of dance where otherwise it would be unattainable because the standard set in terms of those classics, they are ones to be in awe of, to be inspired by, and to create and produce new works that are different, new, and engaging.
Well, you know, we forget sometimes, and, you know, I'm thinking of an analogy to Shakespeare, where we elevate certain forms of art and forget that they were popular entertainment and conceived as such.
Well, yes, you can go to the ballet in Russia, and it was very, very inexpensive to go. It was popular art. You're right.
Well, let's hope it remains popular for a very long time, Jennifer.
Yes, I think that the ballet is going strong and that people who are innovative and are coming up with new designs and stories and are really talking to people, their hearts.
There'll always be
ballet
room for that.
Ballet will thrive.
Oh, I think so, too. Thanks so much for talking with us, Jennifer.
Thank you, Chris.
Jennifer Bell Gray is the co-director and co-founder of the Kauai Dance Center, whose main studio and performance venue is in Lihue, with the North Shore Studio in Kilauea's Parish Hall. And you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including Nico's Pier 38, J.J. Dolan's, and Mission Houses Cafe. Thank you all so much for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline got good news when the Army Corps of Engineers halted the project to study a reroute elsewhere. But could that change in just a few months? With an update on Standing Rock, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth. And lots of news today, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of news. It was a very news-driven weekend. But as this story has been going on, and when the news came yesterday that the U.S. Right. Army Corps of Engineers said that it would stop, and the fact that this project is almost completed, you would think that that would be cause for jubilation. But it seems as if there is maybe a sense of relief for the moment, but only in the moment, and that this isn't really, you know, cause for anything more than cautious optimism in the minds of the people there.
That's right. And as you know, Nick Ruby and Corey Lum from Civil Beat are still there on the ground in North Dakota, and they reported the story yesterday about the Army and the Corps of Engineers, and there was jubilation. People were honking their horns. They were raising their gloved fist in the air, and I emphasize gloved fist because it's very cold up there. But there is also a sense of, wait a minute, is this really over? Because effectively what happened is President Obama is really pushing this down the line to President-elect Trump, and Trump has been on record saying that he supports the pipeline. There was a statement just today from his transition team saying they are going to review what to do about the pipeline. So this may not be over yet.
Which is exactly why it seems that a lot of the folks who are there, some of them at least, are saying they're going to stay through spring.
Right. Nick did talk to a couple of tribal members in the area, not Standing Rock tribe, but Spokane tribe. And they say, we are going to camp out. There's a lot of trust that has been lost and, frankly, not really earned by the U.S. government. And they're very concerned about what might happen. Now, on the plus side, what happened yesterday was a big victory. And folks like Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, who was actually there on the ground as well and spoke to Nick and Corey, said, you know, this is really encouraging. This is not about pitting jobs against the environment and health, but fundamentally this is about protecting water, drinking water. And there's hope also for a number of Hawaiian activists. As we've been reporting, a number of people from Hawaii, not just Tulsi Gabbard, a native Hawaiian activist saying a lot of solidarity here gives them hope for things like the local protest against the TMT on top of Mauna Kea.
And for peoples around the world, as we heard during the IUCN, where there seemed to be a feeling that indigenous peoples from around the globe were coalescing in ways and being able to communicate in ways that they hadn't before and also stand in solidarity with each other.
Exactly. And that was the case that we saw on TMT as well. So there is encouragement that perhaps this is an example of, you know, a peaceful protest can work, can persuade the government to change its mind. We'll see which way that route goes and what the environmental impact statement has to do. But again, the reality check, I think, is what will Donald Trump do going in? In the meantime, some of those folks from Hawaii are coming back. There's at least one student from UH Manoa, a former Marine, who landed, and he told Nick that, you know, he's got to come back. He's got finals at UH Manoa. So they did their work, and they feel very good about what they accomplished. But for some people, they got to get back to the routine.
And beyond all of that, as you said a moment ago, the operative words are, we'll see. Thanks,
there
Chad.
You go. Thanks, Bethann.
We'll talk to you in the morning. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check. Almost 20 years ago, the Peter Borkema case captivated public attention. His parents had claimed the 6-year-old had gone missing after being handed off to a relative. Child Protective Services, though, had already had an abuse history on the family for all of the child's short life. Although the disappearance was eventually reclassified as a homicide investigation, the case remained unsolved. 2 years ago, it was reopened with new evidence. An indictment of the parents came earlier this year. And late last week, Peter Boy's mother cut a plea deal and says she'll testify against her husband. Criminal law specialist Ken Lawson joins us now to talk about this case. Good morning.
Good morning.
The idea that prosecutors would want to get a guilty party to get a guiltier party isn't new. But in this case, the idea of trying to get him on murder seems to be the really problematic part of this. How do you read this case in terms of the ability to convict him?
Well, there's two things, and I think you just raised two issues. One is the state's use of a co-defendant's testimony to convict another co-defendant. And the problem with that, as you know, over the last 20 years or since more years since DNA has been used to exonerate the innocent, a little over 30% of the individuals that have been put in prison through DNA testing and actually showed that they're innocent were put in there based on co-defendant's testimony or informant testimony. And so that's the problem with that. You know, did the mom actually commit the crime and is now blaming dad in order to get a plea deal and serve a little over a year incarceration, at least according to some of the news outlets? But secondly, you know, when you have parents, and I believe the evidence in this case is that these parents had at least abused the child physically before. There have been allegations of that. So when you have a parent who has abused the child to the extent that the child ends up dying, the problem with charging the parent with murder for the prosecution is proving that mental state. And when I say mental state, we try to punish people based on their state of mind. Did you intend to commit the crime, or were you negligent? In the murder case, you have to show that the person normally caused the death of another. And most defenses in these cases like this, when it's a child that dies as a result of physical abuse, the parents say, you know, I didn't mean to kill my child. Yes, I beat him. I beat him like this for years. Yes, I punched him with a closed fist. Did it several times, and we take him to the hospital, et cetera. My intent was to beat him, never to kill him. And that's the problem. That's the uphill battle. So most of these cases end up being manslaughter. And a lot of them were tried to a judge because the judge understands that type of law. When you have a child that's a victim, everybody, including myself, gets outraged, right? Because the child is innocent and could not protect himself from these parents who just continuously. So it's easier to convict with the jury, even though the mental state is not there.
At this point, where the turning point seemed to be having new evidence and having a sister say to the mother publicly, come on, say something, seemed to move that moral outrage that the public has been feeling for all this time. But you've made the point that really looking at the state of mind is going to be the litmus test as to whether or not this comes down to a murder plea a murder conviction, or whether it will be manslaughter.
Yeah, because dad could just come in and say, yeah, I'm not going to dispute it. I did all these things that she's saying, but my intent wasn't to kill. My intent was just to beat the child. She and I did this, you know, for years, or you know what I mean? And one day he died.
How different is this case, or how similar to other cases across the country? Is this something we just know happens, or we don't really hear that much about, and we're outraged because this case happened in Hawaii?
Unfortunately, it happens a lot throughout the country where Department of Human Services or Child Protective Services, whatever the state entity is that's charged with seeing to it that children are protected in the homes, there's a failure in the system. It goes throughout, like I said, it's nationwide. And then what happens is there is public outrage. I don't care how many times you see it. There's something about a child that's helpless and innocent being killed at the hands of the people that are supposed to protect that child that just outrages us all. But it happens. And so there's a lot of blame to go on, or a lot of blame that can go around from the Department of Human Services or Child Protective Services, the caseworkers. Our whole entire system has to take a look at this, because if not, then this young kid, Petey Boy, I mean, he died for nothing. If the mother and father get convicted, manslaughter, whatever, okay, so be it. But it's almost like if there's not a change in our system to help protect children like him, then why are we doing this?
You're saying that unless the system takes this to heart and really reevaluates itself, then perhaps this child has died in vain.
Yeah. Yeah. Why are we going through this motion unless there's going to be some meaningful outcome? And I think at least the state, you know, there's been a lot of interest over the last 20 years that we all owe it to that young child and to all the children that are out there that need to be protected to do something that changes the system.
As this is scheduled to be going to court soon, and as people are dealing with the moral outrage that we've been talking about, is there any way of being able to cover this trial appropriately, to be able to look at it through that lens that you just gave us, and to understand that in some ways the moral outrage has to be put aside and put to better use than necessarily getting a murder conviction in this case?
Yeah, I think, you know, you guys are about to have someone come on and talk about a documentary. She's an amazing person. I just met her out there. But something like that to show, because I think it's not just going to be covering this case that shows how deep this goes into our society, because like I said, it happens throughout the nation. But to show it from the perspective of Child Protective Services, how busy they are, what's the caseworker supposed to do when they get a call from a neighbor, you know, I hear this little boy over there crying, et cetera, what should be the proper response, the prosecutor, what he or she has to do in prosecuting this case, and what the defense is going to do to discredit the mother, because she's getting a heck of a deal.
And that is another thing that seems to be bothering a lot of people. How could she be involved to this extent and get off with a year?
And as you know, it's been pointed out, and then not only not say anything back then, but to go 20 years and still say nothing and get a heck of a deal like this. And I'm sure the defense attorney, when she takes a witness stand against the father, is going to bring these points out.
Thank you so much for coming and giving us your take on this. Ken Lawson is the co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project and an associate faculty specialist at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Among other courses, he teaches criminal procedure, criminal law, and evidence.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Abraham Verghese. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Our sponsor, the Hawaii Community Foundation, is 100 years old. It started in 1916 and was called the Hawaiian Foundation. It was a way to pool the assets of people who passed without leaving a will. Their intent was that these funds would go to support the community. In 1936, it gave its first scholarship to Theodora Floyd to help her go to nursing school. Today, they give out $45 million, including 1,500 scholarships annually. In 2000, they became a statewide organization, enabling it to increase its philanthropic reach across the islands. Over the past 15 years, the foundation has awarded over $32 million to support the environment, $55 million in scholarships, and more than $15 million in grants to Hawaii's nonprofits. They've received some large gifts, but the majority of donors are regular folks, like the seamstress who left a fashion design scholarship, or the humble Japanese couple who wanted to make a difference on Molokai. This is why I always say at the end of our show, our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Can what you eat actually affect how your brain functions? What are the best foods if you've been diagnosed with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or multiple sclerosis? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk to a neuroscientist about what foods best feed the brain and how to make sure you're getting the right nutrients in your diet every day. That's today at 5 on The Body Show.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Holiday Pops, featuring vocalist Natalie I. Kamau and seasonal classics for all ages, this Sunday at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies, as well as the latest news in the astronomy world. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, how you doing? What's going on?
Hey, Dave. How's it going? So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars in the evening sky. Both planets are very bright and easy to spot with the naked eye. The moon this week will be well on its way to becoming full, so that means stargazing is going to become quite challenging towards the end of the week. This month, be sure not to miss the Geminid meteor shower. It will appear to originate near the constellation of Gemini, and it will peak on the morning of December 14th.
Now, from what I gather, you've got a story about NASA on the defensive.
They are indeed. This week, NASA has been called upon by members of the House Science Committee to defend the proposed Asteroid Redirect Mission, or ARM for short. The incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump is looking to gather as much information as they can on proposed missions created under the previous previous administration of Obama. This could mean that some missions may face the axe as political focus is redirected.
And so tell us more about ARM.
The mission itself consists of a deep space probe that would be sent to rendezvous with a small asteroid and redirect it into a stable orbit around our own moon. Essentially, this is a capture and retrieve mission.
How does one redirect an asteroid?
Well, there's multiple ways of doing it. First of all, you can actually grab onto the asteroid with a spacecraft using robotic arms, or you can actually use the gravity of the spacecraft, as small as it is, to help nudge the asteroid off course. There are a few candidates that NASA is looking at, and each one weighs in at multiple tons. The probe will also collect samples from the asteroids and return them to Earth for analysis.
So it's a spaceship that's coming back with stuff.
It is indeed.
That sounds very dangerous and complicated.
It's a risky mission, but not for the reasons you might think. Firstly, the greatest risk is to the spacecraft itself. It could bump into the asteroid and be destroyed. Maneuvering and rendezvous in deep space is tricky business. Now, the risk to the Earth, however, is minimal, as the asteroid that will be captured will be small enough to burn up in the Earth's atmosphere should it get out of control.
And there's no weird viruses or something they could pick up on that thing and bring back to the Earth?
Absolutely not. The asteroids that NASA are looking at are essentially sterile for all intents and purposes.
Here's hoping for steady green lights for that thing. Another interesting report. Thank you, Christopher Phillips.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week for Stargazer.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we reminded you of a Honolulu mayor who spearheaded several high-profile public works projects. As mayor, he oversaw the construction of the John H. Wilson Tunnels through the Ko'olau Range from Kalihi Valley and built the Hawaii International Center, a multi-purpose complex with concert hall, convention center, exhibition hall, and sports arena that was then known as the HIC. He served as mayor from 1955 to 1969 and was president of the United States Conference of Mayors in 1965 and 66. He suffered a stroke while doing yard work and died in 1975 and is buried at Oahu Cemetery. After his death, his successor as mayor, Frank Fossey, honored Neil Shaw Blaisdell by renaming the HIC as the Neil S. Blaisdell Center, and that's the name we were looking for.
And Kathy Osmond called us from Kaneohe, knew the answer, and will be receiving our prize. It's now 8:48. If you've got a question for us, you can send it in, and you might just hear that backyard quiz on a future show. The story of the 100th Infantry Battalion and 442nd Regimental Combat Team is one of fierce loyalty in the face of oppression, a classic American story of success and survival. For author and film director Stacey Hayashi, it has become a life's work. She has just begun principal photography on a feature film about those units called Go for Broke, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
You're, in a way, you're at the end of a long 15-year journey, and
yet you're also
at the beginning of a new one, yeah?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, and the music was very fitting. Thank you so much. That was Jake Shimabukuro's Go for Broke, and mm-hmm. he's actually writing the soundtrack for the film. He's a dear friend, and we're starting principal photography on Sunday, the 11th, so we're all very excited.
And this is not a documentary, it's a narrative film
about, right,
based on nonfiction accounts, right?
Right, and so there are real-life heroes in it, like Ted Tsukiyama, Akira Otani at the Hawaii, the Honolulu Fish Auction, and Bishop Fujitani, Hangwai Ching, Shigeo Yoshida, all these historical figures, you know, that maybe today's generation, you know, never heard of them or...
Well, yeah. Who did what?
Right, exactly.
What is that story? So
this is the story of the fight to fight. So most people don't know what had to happen for the 442nd to even be formed. Mm-hmm. And for example, the original 100th Battalion, they were already in the Army. They were federalized as our National Guard, and they were defending Hawaii. So they were the 298th Infantry, and they were stationed at Schofield. So in fact, a lot of people don't also know that the first guy who was killed in action, the first Japanese-American. His name was Torao Migita, and he was reporting to Schofield. And so that's in the movie, too, you know?
These were young Japanese-American students.
Sort of. They were some of them were adults, you know, maybe like some of them were teenagers. Uh-huh. For example, the University of Hawaii, the ROTC unit, they were activated on December 7th as the Hawaii Territorial Guard. They were given guns and 5 bullets, and a lot of them didn't know how to use these guns, you know. In fact, and there was so much chaos, and they were sent out to, for example, Ted will always tell the story of the Battle of St. Louis Heights, where they were sent, you know, there's that rumor, and it was actually a headline that was printed erroneously, how Japanese paratroopers landed up St. Louis Heights, mm-hmm. and they were sent to go get them when they came back down. And they were, that's why they have battle streamers, actually. They're the only ROTC unit in the nation to have battle streamers because of this. They were, you know, defending Hawaii.
But they were defending against phantoms. There was no...
Well, yes, exactly. But, you know, I guess it's the intent, and we were under attack.
Sure.
And so...
Well, Stacey, just to set the stage, 75 years ago this week, there mm-hmm. was, in the immediate aftermath... Everyone expected an invasion.
Yes.
That's usually what
right.
an attack like
Everyone
this
thought they were coming back.
Is the prelude to an invasion. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think the Japanese Empire was surprised by the success of the attack and mm-hmm. wasn't prepared to invade because they didn't think they were going to do as much damage as they did. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And so there's a lot of stuff that, you know, we all have seen the images of Pearl Harbor, very dramatic. But, you know, a lot of people don't know what happened to local people. You know, mm-hmm. for example, the anti-aircraft shells landed in McCully and they burned people's houses and they killed people. There was a person killed right across the street from Washington Place. So, you know, that's the story we want to tell. You know, like, what was Hawaii doing? Danny Noy, as a 17-year-old kid, was pedaling his bike to the first aid station, you know, to help out. And, you know, waving his fist at these damn Japs, you know. And people don't know these stories, and we really think it's important to share them.
How do the children of Japanese nationals, children and grandchildren of Japanese nationals in the 1940s, become so loyal to their adoptive nation so quickly?
Well, from talking to them, you know, all these years, a lot of them had never been to Japan. So to them, Japan was a foreign country, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah, their parents came from there, but America was all they knew. So, a lot of them resented being sent to Japanese school, which was also an irony because they went, a lot of guys went from the 100th Battalion and 442nd into the Military Intelligence Service.
Right.
And then they translated captured documents and, you know, in fact, they were all over the Pacific, even though they were classified. And so General Willoughby, who was second in command to MacArthur, he credits the MIS with, you know, shortening the war in the Pacific by 2 years and saving over 1 million lives. And I don't think that that's an exaggeration.
Because when we intercepted Japanese transmissions, we had to have somebody who understood what they were saying.
Exactly. And, you know, the Military Intelligence Service guys are the ones who knew where Admiral Yamamoto was heading, and we shot him down. And that so demoralized the Japan, you know, Navy that they didn't tell anyone that he had died for over a month.
He being the mastermind of the Pearl Harbor attack.
Yes, thank you.
It was really the mm-hmm. military genius of,
right.
of that mm-hmm. that whole theater of
yeah.
war.
So all these guys, you know, very critical, you know, they did super important things, and we don't hear about them. But yeah, Hawaii,
when you talk to young people, and you know, you've obviously been on this subject for a long time. You wrote a
comic book,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I guess we have to call it a comic book.
Right? Well, yeah, people, because it's not funny, right?
But you
people.
Put it into that format.
It's cute, yes.
Yeah.
But it's a very serious story.
And in the process, you've talked to a great many young people. And is it your feeling that awareness is slipping away?
Yeah, and that's why I created the comic book, you know, 4 years ago. And I'm happy to say that it's gone so many places that I never would have expected. You know, people use it in universities, actually. And it's but also, you know, it speaks to kids. And they're, you know, these like little black kids in L.A., they're like, wow, this is my favorite book. Now, that's amazing to me. And, you know, because it's not about race, right? I mean, it's about being Americans.
Well, yeah, it's about loyalty, and it's about showing people that maybe you're not what they think
right.
you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the movie. It's going to be, Stacy, I want to sort of, I know you're going to be busy, but let's periodically get together and talk about the progress of this movie.
Yeah, I'd like to
see it through to its conclusion. Yeah, you're just in the early stages.
We are.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stacy Hirashi is the author of Journey of Heroes, the story of the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. She's just begun principal photography on a feature film about those units called Go for Broke. And you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Listening to your conversation with Stacy Hayashi reminds me that it's often very important to meet people where they are to be able to get information out, especially as we're so many generations beyond Pearl Harbor now.
Sure. And it's the great thing about what Stacy has done is that she's really dedicated herself to getting to know all the survivors of the 442nd, the Pearl Harbor survivors. She's very close with many of the families and those who are still with us.
And for those of us who have not been as close to be able to give that account in ways that are accessible.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be talking about some of that this week with some of those survivors.
Well, there's so much that has been done, particularly by the at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific and at the Pearl Harbor Memorial in collating oral histories, priceless information, really, about history.
Which is another way of meeting people where they are, to be able to understand where this country was 75 years ago and what happened in this state. We'll be looking forward to hearing more of those as we move through this week. Now, coming up tomorrow, we will be peering into the past of Pearl Harbor. We'll also be checking in with news analyst Neil Conan.
And the Oahu Choral Society will bring tidings of comfort and joy.
Meanwhile, as we always say, we like to hear from you, and we do. You can call our talk back line anytime you like and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Please be sure to leave us your name and also the town from which you're calling. If you like email, we have that too. That's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find it under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.